Welcome to the Alt Animation Podcast, a podcast that talks about the saltier side of the animation industry. I'm Josh Ryan.
Hi, I'm Robert Orndorff.
We have a really good show for you guys today. We talk about some online animation tools that you can use to make cheap, easy, crappy-looking animations for free. What did you talk about today, Robert? What was the topic you brought up?
I brought up Bandai and said a little farewell and talked about why they're not going to be releasing any new stuff.
Well, we also talk about the Next Media Animation website. We talk a little bit about the reboot. Well, you know, how they're doing the new reboot, and also how it's on Netflix. And we also talked a little bit about the Tintin opening titles.
Also talked about Ronald the Barbarian.
Ronald the Barbarian, yep. So, and the rest of today's podcast is going to include a Q&A by Don Hertzfeldt, and at the end, Cell Therapy by Kevin Cooper, where he talks about the LeBrons, the animated show made by LeBron James.
Yeah.
So it's really good, and I highly recommend you guys listen to the entire podcast. So we'll play that for you right after a word from our sponsors. We're official now. This episode of the Alt Animation Podcast is brought to you by Craftworks. It's a really cool service. Basically, what you do is you go onto their website, you sign yourself up as a seller, and you upload a 3D model that you think people will want to buy. People purchase it, and it gets sent to a 3D printer near their area. You know, that way you're not having to ship this product from China or something like that. So it's a lot better for the environment. It's a lot better for you as a seller because there's really low overhead. None at all, actually. It's the world's 3D marketplace. So basically, anything that you can imagine that you can build in 3D, you can upload to this site, print it, and use it as a real object. It's really cool. They have over 40 different types of materials that you can print on. Some of them are yellow and white gold, platinum, aluminum, ABS plastic, transparent plastic, rubber, stainless steel, all kinds of stuff. So whatever you can imagine, you can print it out. So go to craftworks.com, that's KraftWurx.com, and earn some extra cash and be part of the digital revolution. That's craftworks.com, KraftWurx.com, or you can go to their Facebook page. So one of the trends online nowadays is...
Have we started?
We're starting right now, yes. One of the trends online is being able to go onto a website and making an animation from scratch, right? If you're somebody who doesn't know how to animate something, mm-hmm. there's all these websites that say, hey, come and make a cartoon here, right? You've seen those.
Yeah, you've shown me a few.
Yeah, okay, like the very basic one is, I guess, Jib Jab. You've been to Jib Jab, mm-hmm. right? Where you can put like your face on something or like adjust sliders and make the dude dance how you want to have him dance.
Yeah, you put your friend's face on a dancing woman or something.
Yeah, and that's a very basic version of it. But there are some other ones that are really crazy, like Go Animate, Extra Normal, and Moviso. Moviso is the newest one I saw, and it's really crazy, man. So basically how it works is, you have your character, you have your scene set up, and you can customize it to a certain extent. Way more than, you know, traditional
animation. Give some examples.
Okay, like during Christmas time, a bunch of people were making like Christmas-themed ones. Like, you have a whole group of characters that you can just type in, like, get angry at 1 second, and it kind of translates what you're typing into direction. So you give your characters direction, and they... I think for most of the voices, it's like robotic sounding, but it's better than nothing.
Now, I've seen these.
I don't want to make it sound like I'm promoting these things, because I don't. I would much prefer to see an animation that's actually, you know, crafted well with artistic talent, but they're out there and it's really crazy, so that's why I kind of wanted to talk about it.
Well, it reminds me of something I did circa back in 2006.
And back in the day?
Yeah.
So long ago.
There was a video game called The Movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, for a little while at least, there was a whole plethora of people making their own movies. And, you know, the
game.
Basically, the game had provided you with a way to make machinima and post them on YouTube or wherever you want to post them. And they even had their own website where they were, you know, compiling people's, and they were giving out awards and stuff. And, you know, I did a few.
Really? I want to see them. Do you have them saved?
No, I definitely don't anymore.
I bet they'd be great.
Yeah.
What were they about?
They were all sci-fi.
Yeah?
No, I did a couple of westerns, too. Just so super, super genre-y, you know? They were all 5 minutes long, not very good. I tried to fit 3 acts into 5 minutes, and it was always... they were terrible, you know, but...
You need to find these. I really want to see
them. I think the more fun part about that existing is getting to just the thinking about it and the... it's sort of a zen thing to sit there and make an animation sometimes when you don't have to worry about, you know, S-curves or...
It's a lot more... what's the word? Instant gratification, I guess, is the best way
That's exactly the right word.
Because, you know, traditional animation is going to take you forever. Mm-hmm. And if you want to try to get an idea out, you know, these tools are really well, you know, really good way to do that. And in fact, a lot of people are actually making some money, like the Rooster Teeth guys, the Red mm-hmm. versus Blue people.
Yeah.
They're here in town in Austin, and they have a whole studio.
Yeah.
And they actually do their own original mocap now, but it was originally just all in-game animations.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of punk rock master of animation nowadays, David O'Reilly, who I'm talking about getting an interview with him, actually. He made an entire feature-length film on Extra Normal with, I can't remember his name. He worked on some Adult Swim shows. Or no, the Wonder Showsen guy. Okay. I can't remember his name. But... they made an entire feature-length film in, like, 2 weeks on that Extra Normal website.
Wow.
So it's pretty ridiculous. So if you guys get a chance, go to either Moviso or Go Animate or Extra Normal and check out some of the stuff. And, I mean, there's some horrible ones
on there.
Or
check out the movies in the bargain bin of old brick-and-mortar video game stores if you can find one.
Well, there was a Geico commercial that was made with Extra Normal, too, I think.
Oh, really?
Where they made it seem like, you know, the commercial said... hey, this commercial was made in under 30 seconds. And they were trying to make it seem cool, but at the same time, it looked as if it was made in under 30 seconds. And that brings me to another point. The Next Media Animation, which, if you guys haven't been to this website, it's pretty cool. It's a group of, I wouldn't call them animators. They use mocap and pre-made models, and they just change textures around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the news of the week, done in a humorous way.
Yes.
And I think it's in Korea, but there's a lot of American mm-hmm. people that work there, I guess. And hopefully we're going to get to interview one of them, too.
Yeah?
In the near future. Yeah, I've been talking to one of the guys.
That would be interesting.
We'll see what happens.
We'll find out a little more about it.
Yeah, and that also brings me to another point. The last Autodesk meeting, they had live...
Are you talking about Autodesk User Group?
Yeah, yeah.
Our Austin chapter?
Yeah, they had a live mocap... animation that they were going to do some kind of, I guess, telethon.
Yeah.
It looked good, man. It looked really
good. Sorry, I missed that one. Can we talk to them about not doing it at 3 p.m.?
Yeah, the next one isn't going to be during that time. It's going to be a regular time. But we had to do it during that time for the movie theater to be able to give us a good deal. But man, it was creepy. I thought that this was animated by hand, and then they showed us that it was being live mocapped at that time, and it's starting to look really good.
Yeah,
to the point where, you know, like traditionally,
should we shut down the Alt Animation podcast?
Yeah, just make it the Alt Mocap.
Pronounce animation dead. Should we go find Ralph Bakshi and cut his head off?
You heard it here first, everyone. Animation is dead. But that brings me to another point. I was going to talk about IPsoft. We talked about them on the podcast before, but it's a motion capture that you can do in your own house.
Oh, yeah.
And I definitely don't want this to turn into a motion capture show. We're talking about... and
these are all the really, really easy ways to do animation if you don't know anything about it.
And I guess one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because Don Hertzfeldt is so opposite of this.
I thought
it'd be a good contrast. You know, you have...
you'll make us look like the tools that he'll be talking about in the interview.
Exactly,
okay,
yeah.
Good. I want to look like a tool in front of Don Hertzfeldt. That's good.
Which it is weird because he does talk about how this was one of the first shorts that he's done that used a computer. So maybe Don Hertzfeldt might be doing motion capture in the next couple of years. Yeah. Who knows?
Don Hertzfeldt from 7 years ago. We beat the shit out of Don Hertzfeldt.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But anyway, we talked about IPsoft, and they're a motion capture software that anybody can use using a Xbox Kinect.
Mm.
So, typically speaking, you know, your typical 15-year-old, right, who wants to get into making animated movies, or movies with fully rendered characters,
mm-hmm.
plugs in his Kinect, records himself, transfers it to a model, maybe like that the Morpheus rig or something. You could have a decent-looking animation.
Shut up. These are ideas we've been discussing. No, I mean... half seriously, but...
you know what? Anything for the podcast, man. Whatever will make the podcast good. And that also... we were talking about Tintin earlier.
Yeah.
It's almost creepy how good... Okay, because, like, the Polar Express was creepy
they
because of how they looked.
He jumped over the Uncanny Valley with a horse or some kind of cool...
Well, it's starting to...
I haven't seen it yet.
It's starting to get to the point where...
I know this is a sin, but I haven't seen it yet.
They're trying to not get to the Uncanny Valley by making it still cartoony.
I think that's the right way to go.
But the facial expressions are so good and they're so realistic that you believe that they're real people for a little bit. And, you know, me as an animator, I was totally into the, you know, into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the opening title sequences, if you guys haven't seen Tintin, make sure and watch the opening title sequence. It is really well done.
Show up on time.
Yeah, show up on time. And the crazy thing about it is, I'm almost positive like 80% of the opening title sequence was hand-keyed.
Mm.
And a lot of the Tintin movie had to have been hand-keyed. Like, you couldn't have mo-capped some of that. So I definitely think that there's a, you know, a mixture of mocap and animation now that people are finding that happy medium. You can't go all the way with one or you can't go all the way with the other. I mean, you can't go all the way fully animated, but in terms of production budgets and, you know, traditional directors like Steven Spielberg, they're going to have to translate that, you know, together.
I think the first time they got it right, though, it cost $500 million, didn't it?
Yeah. Are you talking about Avatar?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about this in other podcasts, how the actual animation part of it was totally underplayed and not talked about in all the reviews. And then Andy Serkis
is
back.
You're right. I forget that other people don't have the same perspective of it that I do, that basically there was quite a bit of animation done to make it right, to crawl back out of that valley. And not be in Polar Express land. But
and Andy Serkis has convinced that he's the one. Yeah, he's the reason why.
Maybe no one brought him in the room and showed him that he
Who is the other guy in Planet of the Apes, the main actor? James Franco.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
James Franco now has gone on record saying that Andy Serkis deserves an Oscar. So, I mean, if James Franco says it, it's got to be, 100% accurate.
I like James Franco.
He threw his hat into the ring.
I like actors, but they're not animators.
I'm not a huge
fan. And I doubt they spend the time between takes going and looking at what the animators are doing.
Let's refresh. Let's reboot. All
right.
Reboot is on Netflix now.
Oh, you cheesy.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Yeah, we just watched an episode, and does it hold up?
I think it does. Here, okay, if you guys aren't familiar with Reboot, it's a Canadian and the first fully 3D animated
regular
TV show.
Yeah.
In fact, it came out before Toy Story, so...
1995
was Toy Story, 94 was Reboot.
That's interesting, when we were looking at... Because I didn't remember, you know, one year blurs into another for my childhood, but on Netflix it says 95.
Well, Wikipedia says 94, I'm not sure, but it does say that they started the actual process in 91. So about the time when, you know, Pixar was developing some of their pipeline, which is a lot to say for this little tiny company in Canada, because they are building a production on scale of Toy Story with the amount of characters, at least, you know? And it doesn't have to look as good, but the amount of content that's being produced is considerable compared to Toy Story. So, I mean, you really got to give these guys credit where it's due. Not a whole lot of people know about this.
I think a lot of people look fondly back at Reboot, from our generation at least. I don't think I've ever talked to somebody my age that went, Reboot, that show was terrible. I mean, everyone loved it for what it was. And
well, it was amazing when it first came out.
Come on, you have to remember just the excitement of it being 3D, too.
Absolutely.
Like, you wanted to watch it three times as bad as whatever other cartoon was on.
I mean, you didn't even understand how it worked at the time. Like,
it was
some kind of magic to you,
right,
you know?
It basically was magic.
Yeah.
You know,
which I guess all animation at that time
Did they put a camera inside the computer, man? What happened?
I just remember thinking, it's like you're watching a video game. It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, which was part of it, I think, but...
And now we've come
half decent, right? And it's funny too. I didn't get any of the puns that they have in that show, and it is loaded with computer puns.
It's loaded.
Oh, okay, yeah. And it's that level of joke writing.
But it's great.
The models are some of them are amazing for the time period. Some of them are. You know what? They're all amazing. Even the little ones and zeros have like little things about them that keep them from being a perfectly simple object.
Yeah, you can tell that the people who made this show made it to tell a story mm-hmm. and not just to get the technology out there. Like
that's true.
The core of it was good storytelling.
That's true. But it, I was mentioning earlier when we were watching it that the rendered product looks worse than a previs today.
Yes, it is more fleshed out in terms of like animation, but yeah, some of the animation is really bad. And not to diss the animators, I'm sure that the challenges involved with animating at the time were ridiculous.
I would have a heart attack if I was trying to work on that show, just because all the expectations of a normal TV show as far as production timelines. But doing it with a medium that is completely new. And
I'm sure it wasn't even visually based at the point. I don't think you could like grab the hand and move it to where you wanted. I think it was all, you know, numbers and crunching of things like that.
But it's funny. Graphs. I mean, on the flip side, there were moments where two people are talking and instead of the camera being on the person talking, it's completely on the person who's just standing there and maybe they're nodding their head, maybe.
Yeah.
So they knew where to cut, you know.
Which, you know, is a good storytelling technique for a lot of people, you know. You're not...
Every time?
Well, it doesn't do it every time.
The editing feels very lazy on that show, and it's not, I think, that it's lazy. It's that if they were to cut and be efficient like a regular show, they'd have to show more animation. But I'm not trying to knock the show. Amazing show. Dated, yes, but not... I mean, I think the fact that it's dated, but that it still works is even more of a testament than if it didn't feel dated at all.
Well, if you're wanting to reboot your reboot experience, Robert, they have comic books now that you can... check out. They're pretty well rendered, and if you go to Wikipedia, they actually have a link to a clip that they're showing for the new reboot that they're making, the new movie for it.
Wow.
And they have totally redone everything. The models are really well done. There's some people that...
Is Enzo an adult or a kid? I haven't seen
this. They don't know. They didn't want people to see it, so they took it down, but somebody saved it. And it looks like Bob. But a lot of people aren't liking the style of it. But at any rate, it's still cool to see, you know, kind of the journey.
Is it the same
taken.
Canadian company?
Yes. Yeah, it's the same Canadian company.
Glad to see they're still kicking around.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if they have anything else in the works or what they do exactly, but I'll have to look into it. But
They're Pixar Canada now.
Yeah. No, they've been keeping people updated. And, they did a really cool thing where they... tried to make it community-based, where they had a bunch of Reboot fans online say, hey, submit your stuff. Hey, you know, tell us what you like about this story. They pick the story that most fans liked, and they even hired some artists that were big fans of the show.
Wow.
So just doing cool things like that, I think, you know, I support them
110%. My hat has always been off to Reboot, and it will remain so.
Well, I mean, it's a lot to say when you're the first one to do something like that, you know? So it's amazing the technical feats of an animated show nowadays, you know, they're still huge. And I can only imagine what they were back then.
So we found, Reboot is on Netflix. Still trying to find the Crash Test Dummies pilot.
Yeah.
And the show Roughnecks, which was the computer animated version of Starship Troopers.
Which it looks like it is on YouTube. I don't know how legal that is.
Okay,
but.
Well... I don't care if it's legal or not for the purposes of people checking it out.
Well, let's jump on to what you want to talk about, Robert.
Oh, well, okay, so Bandai Entertainment, no more new shows. They're done. They're going to continue doing their old shows. Bandai did Gundam, Gurren Lagann.
Gurren Lagann.
Yeah, okay, we have a disagreement on how you're supposed to pronounce that, but... A lot of that stuff you saw on Toonami in, what was it, the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I knew nothing really about the company as a whole before now, but basically they're not shutting down, but they're cutting back. And it's funny to find out that they only had 5 employees, but they've let 3 of them go.
And this was the Bandai American branch, right?
Well, there's Bandai America, which is a company. There's Bandai, you know, the original Japanese company. And then there's Bandai Entertainment, which in America, their whole thing was licensing these properties, you know. So they're kind of almost in a way, I think, a shell company from what I can tell. I just, so y'all know what I've looked at, Topless Robot, the website,
yeah,
talked about it, and then
which I think is the best
one.
Name for a website.
It is.
Yeah.
And then the it's completely SFW, but you know, it's just a name. But Robot 6 had another one where they looked at a lot of different people. A lot of people have different ideas of why this company's sort of having to scale back and sort of kind of going under. A lot of it, I think, had to do with the fact that they had to pay Cartoon Network to play their...
See, I thought that was the most interesting part, yeah, of the article. I had no idea that... Okay, so basically, Bandai paid to have...
Bandai Gundam, Entertainment, not
yeah.
Bandai, the
right.
Japanese company.
Bandai Entertainment paid to have Gundam, the Gundam mm-hmm. Wing series, the original one,
mm-hmm.
played on Cartoon Network, which in turn set a precedent
right.
for Cartoon Network to want to get paid to play their anime,
to
which
demand.
I had no idea.
Right.
That's crazy.
Exactly. So any anime played on Cartoon Network after that, it was like, well, these guys are paying us, so you're going to pay us. And I think most of it was Bandai stuff. So they pay for one, and then they get, you know, it's like, okay, well, now you're the payer, so you're going to pay for every show you want to put
yeah.
on here. And they were getting pressure from the original Japanese company, Bandai, to market this stuff. And so they're basically...
Which, I mean, it does sell a lot of stuff.
Right, but mm. they make no money on that. They're the inner, you know, they're
yeah.
the, you know, and those are the details. And this guy was playing the trombone or the trumpet or something while I was trying to read this stuff. But, so I don't have, I can't, you know.
You know what this
know.
Reminds me of? It What's reminds, that? I just got done watching Waking Sleeping Beauty. Have you seen that documentary about
no.
Disney from 84 to 94, like the transition period?
There have been a couple of documentaries about that era.
This one is done by Disney, which you'd think would be a very happy, like, go-lucky thing,
uh-huh.
but it is a very scathing
yeah.
article. And it's so cool because it talks about kind of that time when Pixar was being founded
mm-hmm.
and the time where Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg were fighting and
yes.
then when Jeffrey Katzenberg broke off to DreamWorks.
Yeah.
It kind of chronicles all that, and it gets interviews from all the guys. So I would highly recommend you guys watch this. But the reason it reminds me of it is because at the time they were wanting to cut the feature film division of Disney and say
right.
we don't need it.
Right.
And Michael Eisner had a really good quote where he said, it was Roy Disney at this point. So he said, okay, so basically what we're just going to be is a museum. We're curating a museum at that point.
Yeah.
And you got to constantly have new things that are going out there to have products to back up and sell. Which it seems like that's not what they're doing with Bandai. They're not constantly putting out new stuff.
Well, it cost them.
Well, yeah.
It cost them to do so, you know. So.
Well, and the fact that they're putting out old shows to begin with and marketing that and trying to sell that instead of putting out new material to sell.
Well, like I don't know, you know, the average age of our listeners, but if they're anything like my age, there was a huge boom in anime, you know, in America in the 90s. It started in the early 90s, and then by the late 90s, you know, you had just Dragon Ball had taken over.
I wonder if Dragon Ball paid to have their show on TV, because that would have cost
probably
a
did.
Fortune.
Yeah, I don't know, but they probably did. But
good Lord.
So, you know, you have this sort of weird, this one little company that's technically, from what I've read, according to those two websites, not actually affiliated with the other Bandais, Bandai America and just Bandai, a Japanese company, getting beat up, you know, and sort of exploited by these other companies with the same name but not technically part of the same company, bullying this guy into being their promotional entity. Sorry, I can't think of the right sort of metaphor.
Pusher.
But yeah, basically,
yeah.
You get out, I mean, almost like a pimp and a prostitute. You get out there and make the money, I'll take the money until you can't handle it anymore.
Yeah. Well, we're sad to see Bandai Entertainment go under.
Well, they're still going to be doing their old stuff. They just, I guess, haven't got any money for the new stuff.
Well, on that note, that yeah. sad note.
Ah, for real? No,
yeah.
we got to...
Okay, well, think of something cool. What can we talk about?
I'm going to say it.
Go ahead.
I'm going to say it because I want people to look at this, and I don't know that anyone knows about it, really.
Huh.
Ronal the Barbarian.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Just go to YouTube, type in Ronal the Barbarian. And I think you might see it under Ronal Barbarian, which is the...
It's a Danish animation.
Is it? Okay, it's Danish.
It's Danish. It's directed by a guy... Well, I think the animation director is Fjordborn Kristoffersen. which we're going. Yeah, I actually looked up how to pronounce this guy's name and figured it out because I haven't been able to pronounce anybody else's. But they made an animation that is geared towards adults, and it has adult humor, and it's almost like a Jack Black type of thing.
The best way to describe, well, I don't know what the best way to, the way I'm going to describe it is How to Train Your Dragon with big old balls. Like big,
How to Train Your Dragon balls. Heavy metal.
Yeah.
The cartoon put together.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm going to out what's animation nerd you and say that I just recently bought their movie before this one, Journey to Saturn.
Okay, we're watching that.
Yeah, it was coming in on Blu-ray. It is a...
This guy thinks he's about to leave town after this podcast. He's actually staying right here and watching that with me.
Well, it hasn't come in yet.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. It looks awesome. Go and read the description about this movie. It is going to blow your mind what all they fit into this. And it's a comedy. And it's for adults. So, yeah, the Danish are really kicking some butt.
The only thing you can get on it right now, it hasn't been brought to the United States, Ronald the Barbarian. But you can definitely, they've got way too many trailers, you know, they should have had like just two trailers, but they've got a whole bunch of teasers and then like four or five trailers, it looked like.
Well, and they don't have a US release yet, so hopefully we can help them get some audience here in America, you know, we have a pretty decent worldwide audience, so maybe, you know, some other people will watch it and like it and maybe, you know, rate it high online or something.
But
like
here's the thing. The trailer is in English, and not only that, American English. So they had every intention to release it over here.
Well, no, that was a dub afterwards. They made that after the fact.
Okay. I mean, I made a point to look at their lips, and it looks like they had, you know...
I think that was like an after-the-movie type thing from what I read.
Well done. And that still costs money.
Well, hey, you know what? We'll find out.
So I'm saying they still invested in releasing it over here.
We'll find out all this and more because we're going to actually interview the animation director, Thjorborn, and we'll see what he has to say. But at this point in time, we're going to go to the Don Hertzfeldt interview.
Okay, sorry.
I used the second day. I recorded the first day, the very first time that he played all three of his Bilogy, which I'm going to continue to call it that even though he doesn't want me to. I also recorded the second day. The second day sounds a lot better because he actually got me a cool seat and I'm bragging right now and I got to talk to him and actually get the official word on being able to release this. So we're going to play for you the second screening of the Don Hertzfeldt the movie experience that he's traveling around with. And make sure, he's still going around, make sure that you, if he's coming to your city, buy tickets, buy stuff from him, get him to sign it. Help him out because, you know, he's an awesome animator and an awesome artist in this, you know, in our time. And I just think he's, you know, he deserves everything that he gets. And
I think in our callous world where it's so easy to get something and not look into whether or not someone's getting paid, there are artists who deserve and need... Pick a couple of favorites, and I hope this guy's one of your favorites, one of the people who you bother to support.
Well, one of his quotes that he says in the interview or in the Q&A is he says, oh, you know, I draw very simply and I draw very basically because, number one, he never really took any art classes, so that's all he knows how to do. But he says he really enjoys drawing with this style because people see it and it clicks in their mind, hey, I could do that. And it encourages people to make their own animations, which when he said that, it really rung a bell because that's exactly what I thought when I saw them. I thought, I could do this. No, I didn't.
You should have told him.
Well, I'm telling him right now.
All right.
If he listens to this. But yeah, it was a huge inspiration for me because you see kind of behind the scenes that it doesn't take, you know, a ridiculously fully rendered 3D thing to tell a story. It can be just a couple little pencil drawings. And it really encourages you to kind of do your own. So I just want to personally say thank you to Don for inspiring me. And I think it's awesome that we have him on the podcast. I'm kind of nerding out about it a little bit.
You've been nerding out about it for weeks now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, but stay tuned to the podcast because we got a whole lot more really cool interviews for you guys. And also remember, after the interview, we also have the cell therapy session with Kevin Cooper. And this one is really good. I enjoyed it thoroughly. So make sure you stay around and listen for that. Just a quick disclaimer, if you haven't seen the final Don Hertzfeldt film, you might not want to listen to this interview because there are going to be spoilers. Also, we decided to cut this interview or this Q&A in half so that way we can milk this whole Don Hertzfeldt thing for an extra podcast and have part two on the next one.
So stay tuned for that, and here's the interview.
All right. So, it's a good crowd. Last night, I kind of asked you all the basic questions, kind of in the prescribed order. Tonight, gauging that you didn't seem to really, you don't like the basic stuff. I'm going to jump right into some of my more esoteric questions I've jotted down onto the back of my random Wikipedia notes I printed out about you. And just watching the progression, just having known your films over the years, there's a definite progression from this, like, the most sparse, sticks on black and white animation to, like, this, the creeping in of actual imagery, of non-animated imagery. Even to the point in this last film where you have moments where you have actual footage of people that morphs, like, instantly changes into your stick figure and back and forth. What is it about this kind of seeping in of real life, or I guess what would be considered by mainstream reality into your animation process?
Holy shit.
Let's jump right in.
You did your research last night, did you? I think I just wasn't... I'm still learning. I feel like I'm still learning. I wasn't clever enough years ago to put those kinds of ideas on the screen. I think if you look at just... Everything Will Be Okay, and Proud of You, to the new one. Just little things are progressing. You know, the sound is a little better. I'm learning, you know, a few more camera tricks, and I think that's part of the fun for me. You know, I'm still kind of figuring out new things to do with this camera and filmmaking in general. I think that's a lot of the reason people keep returning to keep making movies. You know, you've got the perfect idea in your head, and you work on it for a very long time. And maybe it's not quite perfect anymore, but the next idea is perfect because it's still fully formed. And I don't know. And as far as the reality stuff goes, it seemed like it just made sense for the story. Because as you know, I feel like it's usually when we're given really terrible news in life that, you know, even if it's just like your girlfriend dumps you or a friend is sick or, you know, a relative dies, it's not until the bad things happen that we're slapped in the face, and you know, you realize that, you know, you've maybe been kind of wasting time or treading water, and it's usually these terrible things that make you see things a little differently and appreciate things a little differently, and it just sort of made sense as I made the new one to get more of that imagery in there. The first shot that I did that with was the shot of him opening his cabinet, that Roger Rabbit shot with his cabinet, and that looked way better than I thought it would, and then I realized I could keep pushing that, and I kept adding a little more. There's very few things that, honestly, I sit down and intellectualize. I feel like I just kind of catch ideas rather than come up with them, and there's a lot of things. I mean, this movie's still very new to me. It's only a few weeks old, and you're the second audience I've ever sat with it with, so I'm sure there's some things I'll figure out in a year. You know, it's not until hindsight that a lot of these weird things that I realized that I was doing that make more sense. If that makes any sense.
I mean, you're talking about it in terms of technique and, like, your toolbox, I guess, but beyond that, on a more intrinsic level, I mean, is it...
Yeah, that too, I think, sure. Sometimes I'll read a great review of a movie and I'll realize that, for better or worse, you know, he made me sound a lot smarter than I thought I was, or, you know, it's not until other people point things out, because, again, I don't feel like I don't self-analyze this stuff. I try not to fall into that trap, because you just get, honestly, you kind of turn into an asshole, and I think, it's very paralyzing, too, to try and figure out, what do I mean with this scene, you know, what am I doing here, you know, it's things that just kind of feel right, and you shape it, and, you know, that scene makes me laugh, so I'll leave it, and that scene makes me think about something, and it's very, it's a lot more abstract than calculation, I guess.
So do you feel, to a certain degree, just, like, becoming more comfortable with the actual physical nuts and bolts technique is actually allowing you just the freedom to do things that you've always wanted to do, or you're actually, is it more... to the opposite effect that you're just now, I think you've just done it character-wise, your characters, because you've been with this Bill character now for quite some time, and I don't even know if it's even right to ask you how much of that character is you, or but like, how much is it, I mean, how much is it?
100%.
100%. Yeah, you gotta tell us, you're in remission.
Yeah, I'm doing much better now.
But I guess, is it, and again, not ask you too many questions you don't want to answer, but like, is it more you feel as you, Don, the creator, your technique is getting stronger, you're able to use tools you didn't know you had before, or is it more like this character, Bill, necessitates these new devices that are coming through in your filmmaking?
Well, as far as the writing goes, I feel like, you know, I think every writer uses things from their life and puts that into their work. I think that's not very unusual. I mean, you overhear something weird, and you, I'm constantly taking notes and listening, and I think every dream in those three films that Bill has was a dream I had. And there's things I'm interested in. There's science things that I'm always, you know, interested in researching anyway. There's things I'm afraid of, and I think that's pretty much the extent of it. I you know, but yeah, I think you're right about the technology. I often don't know what I'm doing. You know, I like to throw myself into these situations where, you know, I don't even have an ending to the movie yet. I'm still working on it, but I know it's going to take 1 year, 2 years to finish. And by the time I'm here, I'll have written to here. And by the time I'm there, maybe I've got this far. And it keeps me plugged in. I don't get bored of the work because it is me 7 days a week, you know, for very long time in weird solitary confinement, just working on these things, and so it's much better for me to be able to make things up as I go a little bit and experiment and try new things, because otherwise I'll get bored, and then the movie would probably not be very good. Did you guys like the lineup? Just not the movies, but the actual lineup of films. Was that work out?
Yeah.
This new tour that I'm going to be on the road for a long time, and it's gotten to where it's like almost programming a concert set list. I feel like there's, you know, you have to pick this and what's going to support this and that. And it's strange. I used to come out on these tours and do these talks, and everyone would be really happy, and I talk about like giant spoons and things. And I was really worried that like on this tour I'll be coming out and everyone's like crying. And I'll be like, we're all gonna die. But it seems like last night went really well, and I think the movie is gonna play pretty good. I'm kind of happy. It's just so strange for me still because it's very new. I'll stop talking.
Well, no, it's great. I mean, so many people probably know Don through Rejected, and or you know, it's good to have Billy's Balloon in there. And it's kind of cool. It's like such an old print, but yeah, it's really awesome to have the more serious work and then kind of later work, and not even like, you know, I guess if you were a concert, you'd be for, if you had an encore, you'd be forced to show Rejected probably as your encore performance. But I was going to ask you about how the tour kind of came together, but you sort of to some degree you kind of answered that. I mean, do you want to elaborate any more on the tour itself?
And I mean, just I used to travel a lot. I mean, I still try and travel a lot with these things. And as far as Rejected goes, I'll probably dig it out eventually on the road. I was in Seattle about 7 years ago, I think, and doing one of these similar things. And as I was being called up to the stage, in the corner of my eye, I just see something like bolt out of the audience right at me really fast and making this motion. And in that split second, I'm like, I'm going to get stabbed to death right now. This is it. This is my horrible end. And as I'm turning to greet this, I realize he has a banana in his hand, and he's going, will you sign this for me? And that's sort of my point of view on Rejected, and just being attacked by weird love for so many years. It's sort of turned into its own thing, and I really like that. It's kind of like, I don't have kids, but I imagine it's like if your kids grow up and they go to college and they get kind of strange and they get long hair and tattoos and strange friends, and it's, you're still your kids, but you don't, you know, whatever, okay.
yeah, as far as the travel and this tour stuff goes, it's really for me, honestly. I after spending so much time on these things, it's number one, just great to go out and travel and meet people. And the main part of it is just I get to see you watch it, and that's, as a filmmaker, I think that's really important, and it's rare. It's getting rarer and rarer because millions of more people are going to see your work on TV, your DVD, or the internet. But I can't be there to see that happen, and I can't, you know, listen to what works and what doesn't work and talk to people afterwards. And it's critical for me. And I think, you know, for like bands, it's the same, and other artists, it's very similar. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's something with a comedy background, because I guess we both have comedy backgrounds, and like we both dealt with serious stuff. Yeah, for me, it's personally a lot. Like, I can sit through an audience with my films as long as it's a comedy, but I can't watch my films that are serious because it's like the silence can mean so many different things. What does it mean for you to watch some of these more recent, especially this one? I guess your only second time to watch it with an audience.
Yeah, well, it's a little freaky because, like you said, I'm used to like hearing laughs and okay, I know I'm doing okay. But when it's complete silence, when a movie's not really going for laughs, that's new to me a little bit. And it'll be interesting, you know. Usually that means you're dying, right, where I come from. But I don't know. I released one movie sort of online, which is the baby being pulled out of the face movie, that more or less debuted on Showtime, and it was just so strange and anticlimactic when it was online. You know, it's just like, it's up today, okay. Refresh. Did anybody write anything? And it's just, there's no energy like this. It's much, much, much worse.
Not to jump tracks at all, but so has anybody in the audience been to any of Don's previous tours?
Woo!
Yeah. Yeah. It was 3 years ago.
Okay, so not too many. So now I can ask you something that I don't know about, but I heard mentioned in the scuttlebutt, is you have a Monty Python story, don't you?
Well, yeah. Well, this is entirely for Clay. This is a story that I feel like I told to death the last time I traveled, but that's why we were.
Say four people.
Yeah, you guys have to listen to this again. I'm sorry, but I really wanted to hear this story, and
true.
It kind of goes into like just influences in general. Like Monty Python was monstrous for me growing up. I was on PBS. My dad rented all the movies, and I think between Python and Stanley Kubrick. And the weird middle ground there is like me trying to do that. I was flown to the Aspen Comedy Arts Festival over 10 years ago now, and I don't remember how the story goes, it's been so long. I had no idea what was going on. I was doing like a screening, but nobody told me anything else about the festival, and I get off the plane, and I get a program over the festival, and there's a Monty Python reunion. And I don't know if they had ever been in the same room together since their last movie. And this was, for me, that's like seeing the Beatles reunite. I mean, it's huge. And I had to get tickets to this thing. I asked all of my contacts. And the thing, of course, is it's sold out months in advance. It's full of wealthy, wealthy people. And I befriended a couple people at the festival. And the night of the thing, we're just like, we can't get tickets. Let's just go to the theater. Let's just look at it. And so we go out, and it's snowing in Aspen, and there's this monstrous line out front. And next door, they're closed-circuit broadcasting a live feed of the reunion, and the line to get into that is twice around the block, sold out, obviously. So we look at the building that Monty Python's in, and we're just like, oh, let's just go get a beer, I guess. Okay. And we trudge out in the snow. We go alongside the side of the building, the alleyway, and there's a door there. And there's this one guy is guarding this door. And this girl I was hanging out with, I don't know what possessed her, but she just walked up to him and just started begging him to let us sneak in. And she's on her knees in the snow and begging him. And this guy's just some local guy, I guess. They gave him a clipboard. And he lets us in. He lets us sneak in. And I'm walking in, and I can't believe that worked. And so we're backstage now, and there's all these people in suits, all these HBO people, and we're just thinking, okay, let's look like we belong here, let's look important. And we wander around the guts of backstage, and we come in, we find a side door, and we're in the theater. And the show hasn't started just yet. It's like 30 seconds to go, and there's still some ushers running around, and an usher comes up to us and says, "You guys don't have seats yet. I think there's a couple in the front row." And there's two seats, front row center, the best seats in the house, and there's a guy there who's been saving them for his buddies who just didn't show up at the very last minute. And so we're front row center, and it's too good to be true. We're like, we're this far away from the five chairs where Monty Python's going to be sitting. And sure enough, there's a security guard that I realize has been watching us ever since we came in through the side. And I, in the corner of my eye, I see him, he's making a beeline for our chairs. And I've got like white knuckles on the armrest. Like they're gonna have to fucking drag me out of the seat right now. I'm so close to seeing Python. I'm gonna make a scene. And like I said, this was like 10 years ago, and I was kind of I had like kind of long hair back then and like a goatee thing going on, and I was kind of scruffy looking. And because he saw us go from backstage right into the front row, he thought I was Johnny Depp. And he just wanted an autograph. We got to see the Python reunion from the front, and it was fantastic. It was like a religious moment. I couldn't believe it. Sorry? Would you have given him the autograph? So yeah, that was like a religious moment for me, to see that. That was amazing.
Did they think you were, did Monty Python think you were Johnny Depp?
I don't think so. I don't know what that guy was thinking. I think at film festivals, you expect to see famous people. Like, you know, at Sundance, when you walk down the street at Sundance, there's this, like, it's like a double take for everybody you pass by and everybody who passes by you. It's like they look at the badge, they look at your face, they look at the badge, look at the face, are you famous? And you keep going, everyone's constantly doing this.
I remember that. Last year at Sundance, they made the name smaller on the badges because they were like, we want people to see people. So all it did was it made people more obvious about checking out your badge. It'd be like, you like, have to lean in? Like, come on. Like, so do you want to open this up to questions? Get some questions from the audience. Does anybody have any questions? I see one right there.
The driving at night scenes in this movie were really spectacular. I was wondering how to be captured that, because it seems very smooth and there's no one on the road.
Thank you. There's quite a few driving scenes. The majority of them, I shot... Well, I should preface this by explaining how I shoot everything. Everything winds up on 35mm. I've got these old cameras that I've kind of talked about to death, I think, but they're these old Acme downshooters. They're like 800-pound monstrous cameras, and it's basically the cameras pointing straight down on your artwork, and everything in those movies that looks live-action-y, it's footage that I shoot, and then every frame is turned into a 4x6 photo still. And so for like a sequence of like branches or something, there's hundreds and hundreds of stacks of these 4x6s that I then shoot under the camera one frame at a time, like animation would be. And that, it makes it kind of jittery too, and gives it almost like a silent movie like look. And even for, there's a couple shots that are stock footage of the new one, that, but it goes through the same process. And then as I'm shooting it, I can also add weird light effects. And I think the bulk of that movie, I want to say the bulk of that movie is out of focus. And I shot a lot of it through magnifying glasses, very cheap plastic magnifying glasses to kind of warp the image. A lot of it's shot through broken glass. There's even some toy packaging. Like there's a, like when you get a toy, you know, you get like a plastic shell over the cardboard backing that the toy comes in. And I found a really cool looking one that I stuck under the camera lens to kind of warp the image a little interestingly. But anyhow, so the camera, or the driving sequences, I don't want to sound reckless, but I'm just driving around with the camera, like in my hand. And then, they're all printed out, like I said, and they're just kind of futzed with from there. You know, it's there's even a few digital special effects in that movie that I've never gone down that path before, but it goes through so many weird layers because it all has to wind up still under that camera. So I'll go from analog to digital back to analog again, and then I'll add a few more layers of weirdness while I shoot it. But every shot is a little different, because every shot is sort of built from the ground up and reverse engineered in a way from the page. The phone scene. We got that question last night. Yeah, I'm so happy that people are asking. I'm not going to tell you. Well, I don't want to sound like I'm coy or something. First of all, the movie's still very new, but I feel like as audience members that we all know sometimes just too much about how movies are made, and how special effects are made. Like it's very rare that I hear about a movie anymore where it's like, wow, how did they do that? Because when I was little, I learned all about armatures and cloud tanks and matte paintings and all the optical effects. And I remember seeing The Empire Strikes Back when I was 4, and grown-ups were arguing over how the Tauntauns were made. And I distinctly remember a conversation where someone was convinced that they were kangaroos in costumes. And I think that's just really kind of magical that, you know, you have to maybe work it out a little bit and maybe you shouldn't know everything. The trouble is, I think these days, with computers, nobody knows how computers work, and everyone just assumes that, oh, they just use a computer, like there's a make art button on a computer, it's so easy, and I feel like the computer animators really get the shaft half the time, because nobody really understands what they do or how they do it, and it's just, oh, they're just doing what it has a computer, and so, anyway, I'd rather not go there, but it's a mix of things. Every shot's a little different, like I said, and there's some optical stuff. There's a few digital hybrids, that's really cool. It's 2 nights in a row. I'm happy that shot works. I'm happy, yeah.
It was funny you mentioned that, because I was like talking to some people the other day about Jurassic Park, because like how the first Jurassic Park looked so much better than like all these other CGI movies later, and it's because it was still like a mixed bag toolbox at that point. Like you had guys who come from other disciplines who had the art background, who would learn to use the computer instead of vice versa. Because it's like nowadays, like kids like learn the computer first, then they learn some degree of artistic background.
Yeah.
But it's like, you can see the difference, even like something in technology is like 15, however many years old now Jurassic Park is, and it's like versus today, where it's like, it looks just as good, if not better, than the majority of the stuff is coming out. Which is interesting to me, kind of harking back to what I was talking to you about earlier, is the idea of just like, as a filmmaker, having just a broad canvas and just having a big toolbox for you to pull from, and which I'm really curious about you, and just because I'm a narrative filmmaker, I can just point a camera at things. That's all I can do. I can't draw. I can't draw a stick figure. But it seems like you're getting more and more into the point that you're just using every conceivable tool that's available to narrative filmmaking. And it almost makes me think like, oh my God, your next one's gonna have some live action or something. I don't know if it's going that way, or if this is, you're alluding to that to some degree with this film, that you, because you have these little brief, like little flashes of live action. Obviously it's not live action, but it's re-photographed live action, but.
You know, it's just part of the fun. You know, I think the last few films would have been impossible to make without these old cameras, just with the way they're put together and the way that I often don't know what I'm going to get until I get the film back. And that's, for me, that's just, it's, I mean, I know for a lot of people that would be a big nuisance, and film is a nuisance, but it's just fun. It's part of what keeps me returning to the thing every day, because it's such a drudge work, it's so boring. It's most of the time, I mean, anyone who's ever worked on a movie knows it's maybe 10% creativity and excitement, and 90% just like complete boredom and just drudging, dumb labor. And so, you know, it keeps me plugged in, and that's really the best way I can describe it. And I think, you know, as far as the next work goes, I think I might be done with shorts for a while. I think, you know, they take so much out of me, and I'm so not that young anymore. And I am finally ready now that the Bill stories are through. I'm making the very first baby steps now and getting a feature off the ground. I'm really looking forward to not having to draw everything over and over again by myself. It's going to be interesting for me, because I'm used to coming up with an idea and animating it that weekend. And now there's going to be a lot of money meetings and a lot of investment meetings and a lot of pitch meetings. And I'm convinced most of this money is going to have to come from overseas. I don't want to tell you too much about this feature project, but it's a period piece with my artwork, more or less, a little more fleshed out. And it's 2D. And you can tell from right there that all the studios are going to be falling over themselves to get to that. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to, I think if anything, it'll test my patience to see if I can really just wait to work on something again that long.
You had a little bit of a studio background a couple years ago, yeah?
Oh, a long time ago, but I've never had anything get off the ground. It's just, and I think it's been for the best. You know, I've never wanted to take commercial work. I've never really been, for lack of a better word, successful. And I think, you know, I was too young back when those movies were getting weird and big, and anything I would have done at the studio 10 years ago probably would have been bad. You know, I realized that I was pitching for the sake of pitching, and there's a great Martin Scorsese quote that says, don't make the movie you can make the movie you want to make. And that sounds kind of stupid and trite, but it's actually kind of true when you're in the trenches of filmmaking, that it's kind of rare that you've got the opportunity to make the movie you want to make. And I've had that weird freedom for so long now to just, you know, I figured I've got this audience somehow, and I can make a living doing these shorts, and they pay for the next one, so why am I trying to please these Hollywood people when I can kind of tell these stories I want to now? But anyhow, who's next?
Someone over there?
That was kind of
a
vague.
Yeah, sorry.
Over there.
Two rows and over that way.
Dibs.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of discussion about your technique, and it is really cool, unique, and skilled. I don't think any of that would matter if the story didn't land on people. And so I want to hear more about your writing process, and you say you just sort of have a bit, and then eventually you'll have the next bit, and I don't buy that. I mean, do you? What's the editing like? And do you involve people? Is it just you? You know, how does that work?
It isn't just me, unfortunately. And I think the worst thing a writer can do is sit down in front of a blank page and just be like, today I'm going to be creative. You know, nothing ever good comes from that. You have to write when it's time to write. It's like a body function, like going to sleep or going having a pee or something. It's, you know, when you're ready to go, you go. And works. Lord. It is, for me, it's very, and this is, again, it's wading into dangerous, pretentious artist-sounding conversation right now, and I'm trying to avoid that, but it's almost just completely subconscious. You know, it's things that I don't know where they came from. It's just an interesting idea, and I'll write it down. I've got tons of post-it notes all over the place, and I'm constantly just jotting things down, and when it's time for me to write, put them into a form. It's really gathering all these weird notes and saying, well, I like that scene, and this might work for this other thing. And I'm also constantly keeping a journal. I have a journal online that's been there for over 10 years. And sometimes I just go through it and steal things. Like, if you actually were to sit and read the whole journal, 10 years of it, you'll find a lot of scenes from these movies that maybe I saw in the supermarket one day and then later came back and stole it. Yeah, I you know, the subconscious is just a weird place. I read about, like, other artists, and they've all got their own ways of working. Like, some writers can only write standing up. Some can only write, like, drunk. David Lynch meditates to kind of, he calls it catching fish, and he wants to meditate to get deeper in to catch fish. I think everyone's just kind of got their own different word for the same thing, and to me, I think the subconscious, it's like this party in your head that you're not invited to. There's like a heavy black curtain separating you from this party, and every now and then you can hear music coming from there. You can write it down, and maybe there's like a hole in the curtain where you can glimpse something, but I was reading, you're going to be really sorry you asked me this question. There was Well, there's two things I was reading about the same thing recently. There was one was the Robert Louis Stevenson wrote about this in the back of one of his Jekyll and Hyde books about how a dream he had, and it was like a murder mystery, and it was like a really interesting murder mystery in his dream, and he was really riveted. And at the end, there was like a red herring and a twist and like a surprise ending. And he woke up and he was like surprised, like, wow, that was a great mystery. Like, I had no idea how that was going to, who wrote that? And he, it was like this weird, you know, idea he had, like, how could he have been surprised by that when it was his own mind creating it? And I was reading the science experiment about, I'm going to really paraphrase this and I'm going to screw the whole thing up, but in a nutshell, their brains were monitored and they were given a clicker and they were shown slides and they were said within the 3 minutes of watching these slides, you have to press the clicker 10 times, but anytime you want to do it, just press the clicker. And I'm screwing the whole story up, but the basic conclusion was they had the free will to just click it whenever, and every time they made the decision and made the click, the part of their brain lit up where you can see the decision being made consciously, and then the click was recorded. And there's like maybe a split second between that, I'm going to click it now. And every time there was a conscious decision lit up, a part of the subconscious brain lit up just a hair of a second before that decision was made. So in other words, we're led to believe that we're piloting the ship, but everything we do is fed to us from the subconscious a hair of a second beforehand. And the scientists who were writing about this were just like, you know, wait till the lawyers get a hold of this, because, you know, there's no free will. You know, he didn't murder him, his subconscious told him to murder him. And, but it is really interesting stuff, just how, you know, the consciousness is just put there to make us think we're in charge, when we're maybe just puppets of something behind the scenes. So that's where all the writing comes from. I try not to think about it too much because I don't want to screw it up. And I just read about other artists and I say, that's kind of interesting, that's similar, but I think a lot of writing is just finding a place where you're comfortable and whatever works for you, however the ideas come through, it's very personal.
Hello, hello, and welcome. You are listening to Cell Therapy, where you get the help you need to satisfy your cartoon addiction. I'm Kevin, your host, and I got a lot to cover this episode, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. And for this Cell Therapy session, we're going to take it over to YouTube for a cartoon called The LeBrons. Yes, you did hear me correctly. This is a cartoon created by the all-star basketball player LeBron James. Now, before you jump down my throat about this, let me say that I probably had some of the same thoughts as you did or are now having after me telling you this. And I was like, LeBron's? Seriously? Why is he trying to do this? But being the cartoon person that I am, I had to check it out. And I must admit, I was very, very impressed with what I saw. He really did his homework on this. And, you know, I often question whether or not people actually take cartoons seriously and if they're using it as something to kind of promote themselves or something that doesn't really have a lot to do with cartoons. But I gave it a shot. And like I said, after watching the entire series, I honestly felt like LeBron did his homework and he's an actual cartoon fan. So I can appreciate the fact that that he came correct on this. So let me talk about the format a little bit. Each episode is from 6 to 8 minutes long with a total of 10 episodes. With the way that it's written, it does feel like a full 22-minute episode. It has just enough drama to keep the story flowing and not feel over the top. If you look back at cartoons like, Batman anime series or Disney's Tailspin, those are kind of written for network television. In the middle of each episode, they cut to a commercial on a cliffhanger and then come back at the end for the conclusion. The LeBrons feels a little bit different because it doesn't take a break in the action. It still manages to maintain that beginning, middle, end type of storytelling that we're used to. And really, all the things that normally would require a commercial break are contained within the cartoon. I'll go into more detail on that in a little bit. The cartoon, it starts off with LeBron James himself in live action, giving you the breakdown
of the story. Now, that's definitely a throwback to Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. I can see where LeBron is coming from because it does serve as like this historic tie-in to the cartoons that he grew up with. So maybe it's trying to get people to do the research to see how much reference went into his creation. So the main cast consists of different parts of LeBron's personality. So all of their names are these different personalities. You have Kid LeBron, the main character, Wise LeBron, the old man, Business LeBron, speaks for herself, and athlete LeBron. All of them living in the same house to bring out the best parts of each other. This story is pretty much like a high school drama dealing with like dating, bullies, sports, life lessons, and all of that stuff. And even that's a throwback to some of the afternoon specials that used to come on TV. Moving on to the animation and artwork, it really does look great. This is network quality tunage on YouTube. And usually with a lot of web cartoons, stuff done in Flash or whatever the art program is, there's a huge difference in the quality of the animation, which is understandable because you don't have a big budget to hire a bunch of people. So you end up cutting corners where you can. And with the LeBrons, I could really see this right next to any cartoon in the afternoon lineup. That's how good the quality is. And I'm blown away that you would see something like this on the internet coming at you through YouTube. Another thing that speaks very well for the cartoon is the fact that it has a black cast, because for one, it's very rare to see that. And second, it helps to make the toonscape diverse. So if you look on TV, I think that the Cleveland Show is the only ongoing cartoon with a black cast. And really, it's one of the few shows in general, live action or cartoons, that have a black cast. So to me, that's a good look. And it really needs to be more shows like that. Now, that particular aspect of the cartoon leads into a conversation that I had with a friend after watching the first episode of the LeBrons. Now, to kind of set it up, in the first episode, Kid LeBron and his friend are getting chased by the neighborhood dog. They eventually get the help of a lion to solve their dog problem. The animals start off in character, the dog and the lion, and there's a couple other characters in there as well. But they start off in character, but later become talking characters that interact with humans. And he really didn't care for that too much, and he said it kind of took him out of the cartoon a bit. You know, and I really had to disagree, because looking around at the networks, it's very common to have some sort of obscure talking animal who often jumps in and out of character. And as a matter of fact, that's really part of the formula, and it has been for years. Look at a cartoon like Family Guy or Phineas and Ferb. Although Perry in Phineas and Ferb, Perry the platypus, he doesn't talk, but he's still doing things that an animal would not do. So that's nothing new. And another thing is that, you know, he felt like some of the dialogue was a little cliche for black characters. Now, that's normally a pet peeve of mine. You know, it makes me feel kind of weird or a little it takes me out of the cartoon to just hear like this random piece of slang that nobody's used in a million years, just thrown in to the cartoon for comedic effect. You know, that's normally a pet peeve of mine, but it honestly felt good to me. I didn't have any problems with it. And sometimes when you're delivering lines, it's not necessarily what you're saying, but how they were saying it and how expressive you have to be when speaking life into an animated character. It is set in LeBron's hometown of Akron, Ohio, so I don't think that brand A vanilla dialogue would fit these characters. Let me take a step back, because I also had to break it down even further. The lion and dog thing is actually a throwback to an old Looney Tunes short from 1955 called Dime to Retire. And in this short, Porky Pig finds a hotel that costs only 10 cents to stay there, and it's being managed by Daffy Duck. The gag there is that there's always a pest in the room to disturb Porky, and he has to pay extra to get rid of it. It starts off with a mouse in the room, so he has to call down to the desk and get a cat to get rid of the mouse. Then he had to call a dog to get rid of the cat, a lion to get rid of the dog, an elephant to get rid of the lion, and then it comes around full circle because he has to call a mouse to get rid of the elephant. Now, I can't really confirm that reference, but if so, LeBron really did his homework on this, and I have to give him credit for that. And then for the rest of the series, the rest of the series is full of little gems and little references just like that, which is cool because all of the other episodes are better than the first one. So with this first episode, it starts off in that pilot format where you're establishing your characters, you're establishing the world in which this cartoon is taking place. So the real meat and potatoes of the series has to occur in the later episodes. So for me, it started off good and got even better the more episodes I watched. I'm going to wrap it up with the delivery method. Remember earlier when I was saying that everything that normally would be a commercial is contained within the cartoon? Here's how. There are a lot, and I mean a lot, of very blatant ad placement. Stuff like HP, Bing, and Intel ads all over the place. I'm not really a fan of that, but I understand you got to do what's necessary to fund the project and to kind of bypass the networks, which brings me to my next point. I like the road that they took in order to get this product out there. LeBron's celebrity status, I know, will pull in some sponsors and other people who want to attach themselves to this project. That way, you really don't need the networks. And I wonder if they actually pitched this for television, got turned down, and then LeBron said, you know what, screw it, I'll do it myself. I don't know that for sure, but I wouldn't doubt it. And the reason why I say that is because network television has gotten so incredibly competitive that it's not enough just to have a great cartoon. You need the toys and the video game and the bed sheets and the this and the that. You need all of that sort of stuff to go with it. Symbionic Titan is a perfect example of that. Awesome cartoon, beautiful. And it got canceled because it did not have that strong toy line. And that's how it is nowadays. Networks are looking for that extra stream of money. That's why I think it's a great idea for LeBron to take this path of going straight to the audience via YouTube. If you think about it, it actually is inspirational. Makes me want to hit up a few local businesses and see if they'd buy some ad placement in the cartoon. And it doesn't have to be like an ad placement specifically, because I guess if it was set in some sort of fantasy world, you really wouldn't see a character holding a Pepsi. But I mean, something like a banner at an event or a mention in the credits, something on the website. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Just something inside or outside the cartoon that they can buy to support their businesses, and that at the same time they're helping to fund the project. And I know that there are a ton of indie productions out there that have climbed mountains and did everything they could to fund their project, but I'd like them to get this type of marketing and sponsorship so they don't have to starve to death chasing their dreams. That's all I got for today, folks. Thanks for joining me on this therapy session. I hope that you got the help you needed to satisfy your cartoon fix. Tell me what you think about the LeBrons by going over to celltherapy.net. That's celltherapy.net. And leave some comments. Also, email me at celltherapymail. That's celltherapymail@gmail.com. And tell me what cartoons you're watching. Best way to keep up with Cell Therapy is to follow me on Twitter. At Cell Therapy. I might be watching the same cartoon you are. Big, big, super huge thank you to the Alt Animation crew. Be sure to join me on the next episode of Cell Therapy.